Lakesh was looking distant. His eyes were fixed on the giant world display map, but he clearly wasn't seeing it.
His product truly was the best suited to the totality concept's needs. And there were those of us who felt guilty over what had been done to his father.
He turned to face her.
It may seem strange to you that men who could envision, who could engineer the deaths, ultimately, of billions of human beings might feel guilt over one mere individual, dead for years, and some would say deservedly so. But it is another thing when that individual is a colleague, and it is a hard thing to deprive a son of his father, and yes, his mother as well. Although in all my time with the totality concept, I never heard so much as a hint that her demise had been anything but what it seemed, but I never doubted that if it really was Mabel Bates's finger that pulled that trigger, it was because another's hand forced it there. We had done the boy a very great evil. Yes, yes, you need not say it. We imagined depriving billions of sons of their fathers, and we did so deprive them. Evil we did, in plenty. Oh, yes. But again, the Bateses were our own. They were people who counted. Masters, not servants, not...
Cattle. I think that we are property, Charles Fort said. He also said, pigs, geese, and cattle first find out that they are owned, then find out the whyness of it. Well, Lakesh, we have learned the who-ness of it as well. Who presumed to believe they had the right to own humanity?
He was carefully not looking at her, which was just as well. The emerald laser glare from her eyes might have burned out his.
Oh, yes, we presumed much. We presumed all. And I have borne the burden of guilt for longer than the span of a natural man's life, although I slept the cold sleep of years.
He turned to her, reached out his hand as if to touch her.
You must not misunderstand, Domi, my darling. Oh, forgive me. It is this unnaturally accelerated aging process, I am sure, which robs me of my mental faculties. I beg your forgiveness. Have pity on an old man.
Yeah, yeah. What else do we know about Bates?
Gilgamesh Bates. The very name was a taunt, tossed in the face of the Archon Directive by one of its core members. But the younger Bates was never a part of the totality concept himself. He was a contractor, an outsider, nor was he initiated.
But he knew.
Yes.
And that's not all he did, is it?
Lakesh's gaze was almost serene.
No. I should never have imagined the truth might hide from you, once I myself set you on its track. You are a very nemesis. You are well matched with friend Kane.
She felt a stab of wild hot anger that he presumed to mention her supposed spiritual link to Kane. She suppressed it. He was trying to provoke her, dammit, trying to throw her off the scent, even as he applauded her refusal to be eluded or decoyed.
It would appear, as you have no doubt inferred, dearest Bridget, that Gilgamesh Bates devoted his entire life and astonishing career to one end, to identifying the man who had killed his parents and, in a way, infiltrating them.
To destroy them?
Oh, no. Marvelously, superlatively have you researched the man, but you have not yet grasped his soul. He wanted to gain power over them, over us. Although I did not join the charmed circle for years after his parents' deaths. Indeed, he was acting out the myth of his namesake. He wished to seize power from us, the gods, for so we acted, and so the barons whom we set up act today, and bend us to his wishes. More than that, more even than vengeance for his mother and his loved and hated father, he desired to compel us to yield to him the gift of Utnapishtim.
The secret of eternal life. But remember, Lakesh, in the epic, Gilgamesh fails the final test. He never wins immortality.
And in the end of this story, it was not Bates who cheated death, but we who cheated him. As hollow a victory as that admittedly was, I admit to still taking pleasure from it.
But the rumors that he made plans to freeze himself and possibly others...
Preposterous. They said the same thing about Walt Disney. Do not forget, most beloved Bridget, he was not of the circle. His resources were vast indeed, but they were not ours. We really did have alien technology to draw upon. All his billions could not duplicate that.
Are you certain of that?
Lakesh jerked his head back as if she had slapped him.
He built back doors into the software the Totality Concept bought from him, out of whatever bizarre, creepy sentimentality its members possessed, instead of normal human compassion. He siphoned your data the way he siphoned that of all his previous blackmail victims. Couldn't he have stolen the most up-to-date research reports on your cryogenics projects as soon as they were filed?
Lakesh's normally dark cheeks had the hue of wood ash.
What else might he have built into your software? It's the same software Cerberus is running now, isn't it? So it was no accident that you set me to researching Bates the moment I finished analyzing the electronic intrusions.
Bates is dead. Dead and dust. He had degenerative heart disease. Without access to technology which no human had access to before the war, he would have died within a few years of the nuke cost, if he did not perish in it. What I fear, though, is that someone may, in turn, have learned his secret.
Just why are you so sure that...
Excuse me, folks?
Banks had been sitting dutifully at a monitoring station not 10 feet from them, with his headphones on and his eyes fixed on his screen, paying them no more attention than if they had been holding their discussion on the Parallax Red space station.
What is it, friend Banks?
Sorry to interrupt, but our traffic analysis is showing that anomalous signals are being routed through our functioning commsats.
Anomalous?
Yes, signals of unknown origin. Encrypted, sir. They don't match anything we've ever seen used by the Baronies or by the Trust.
He looked up at the big Mercator map as his fingers played his keyboard. A yellow pinpoint glowed into existence not far to the south and east of the green X of Cerberus itself.
And they appear to be originating from the ground in north-central Wyoming.
The new light glowed right next to a white light which had already been present.
Why, that's almost where Domi is.
What do you make of it?
Hayes was keeping watch in the turret of Big Bob, switching between the radar display and sweeping the afternoon sky with his pale blue eyes. Sean Reichert shook his head at the smoldering mass that had been an attack helicopter and two human beings.
I'd say that's definitely a cleanup on Isle 9.
He was hunkering down nearer the still-hot wreckage than Robeson or Weaver cared to get.
What I can't see is, why an Apache?
Pretty deadly gunship.
Almost got you.
Yeah, but he didn't.
His grin was dazzlingly white beneath his mustache and against his cinnamon-colored skin.
Yeah, they're lethal when they work, but I remember what my buddies who'd been in the Gulf told me. Total hangar queens. If they hadn't been able to FedEx spare parts from back in the world, the Apaches would have had to sit out Desert Storm.
You got that right. Good thing we kept our Cobras, huh?
Yeah, well, you jarheads are so conservative. Most of you still agree with Chesty Puller that you never should have given up your Springfield 03 bolt guns.
Don't be talking about Colonel Puller there, son. But it just so happens I disagree with old Chesty on that one. I'm with Patton instead. The M1 Garand is the finest combat weapon ever designed by the hand of man.
Weaver stood with his head cocked to one side, regarding the wreck.
Select parts.
Say what?
At the labs, I heard a rumor several times that the real maintenance problems with the AH-64 resulted from contractors subcontracting replacement parts to overseas concerns without too big an interest in quality control. Perhaps if whoever laid these helicopters down initially made sure of getting prime quality parts from the original manufacturer, rather than third-party knockoffs, a lot of maintenance problems would have magically disappeared.
What I really want to know is, how come he kept taking hits from my 50 without smoke coming out?
Reichert bent and picked up a plate-sized black shard from the ground near his right knee, then stood and walked back to the Lab 25. He spun the fragment up to his commander, Frisbee-style. Hayes caught it one-handed without blinking.
That's some kind of lightweight ceramic. Bolt-on conformal extra armor. Didn't add much weight, didn't add much drag. It's not as if anybody was expecting these things to have to dodge MiG-29 fulcrums after the nuke cost and everything.
Hayes eyed the shard in disgust and tossed it back to the ground.
I knew they were making stuff like this. Just didn't know how far they'd gotten with it. But don't you see? It's not how far they got. It's how far they didn't get.
Hayes peered at him over his yellow-tinted Zeiss prescription shooting glasses.
You lost me there, son.
The wind carried the smell of rain from the north.
Flying saucers.
Hayes and Robeson stared at Weaver.
Our young friend Mr. Reichert is puzzled why, if what Gilgamesh Bates told us yesterday was true, our friends here were riding around in a 200-year-old helicopter with a history of maintenance problems, shooting at us with rockets and machine cannon instead of a flying saucer firing death rays.
I think I see why the unguided 57mm rockets and the lighter chin gun. Why go to the trouble of maintaining fancy ATGM systems, or for that matter, stocking up on super-caliber armor-piercing cannon shells, when all you're going to be doing is hunting raggedy-ass survivors on their tarted-up bikes and dune buggies? It wasn't as if they were planning on stopping the 8th Guard's army at Fulda Gap with these machines. You could be flying around in a crop duster with a Browning Model 05 auto-loading 12-gauge and still be master of the world.
You speak true, but the real question is what Joe said it was. Where are the UFOs? Why weren't we tractor-beamed aboard the mothership and strapped naked to shiny metal tables with a bunch of little big-headed bald dudes peering up our butts with penlights?
Well, one obvious answer to that would be that Bates lied.
He cast an uneasy glance in the direction of Major Mike in his turret.
Or was crazy as a garbage bag full of mud daubers, but we knew that before. What we know now is that a threat like the Baronies he described does exist, and it packs some real serious hardware. Which also means we better not spend too much more time standing out here with our teeth in our mouths, right next to a giant black column of smoke that happens to be visible for about 100 miles in any direction you care to name.
The redoubt outside the ruins of Houston had apparently suffered sympathetic effects from the Pacific Rim Earthshaker nukes. The ground had sunk several feet, so that the lower foot of the entrance door was submerged in water. Years before, the barony of Samariumville had built a cypress wood dock that jutted from the overgrown green mound, concealing the redoubt itself. The dock allowed access without having to wade over the slimy, treacherous bottom to get to the doorway. The dock wasn't in excellent repair. The trees, broad-leafed, with a not altogether natural blackish tint to the green, had encroached close upon it. Branches, weighted down with lianas, hung low over the dock. Mostly it was used by swampies, and the non-muty swampers, whom the magistrates didn't regard as very much more human. Baron Samarium's manpower, like that of all the barons, was stretched thin, way too thin to waste it securing a facility no unauthorized personnel could get to or use. But there was at least one renegade magistrate on the loose who knew the access codes. And the Samarium Mag Division's intelligence department had received confused reports of intruders with an interest of their own in the rogue. Samariumville magistrates Simon and Pindar thought it was all bullshit. They would. They were the mags currently stuck with the duty of guarding the dock.
From what? Mosquitoes and water moccasins?
The slightly concave faceplate of his hard-contact helmet did nothing to mask his dissatisfaction. Somewhere off beyond the ruins, the sun was going down, unseen for the dark ramparts of trees. Dusk seemed to solidify around them as what they could see of the sky turned to a blaze of orange and green. Crickets were already chirping. Less identifiable beings were making less readily classifiable sounds as night threatened the swamp.
Will you shut your pie hole for once, Pindar? Who cares from what? We got our orders.
But why? What are we mags for? We might as well be pitters stomping around this sewer with these creepy-ass vines dripping water down our necks that gets all down the neck of the suits and just chase the hell out of me. And the bugs crawling in all everywhere. I hear tell there's bugs out here, little tiny bastards, climb right up inside the piss hole of your dick, then anchor themselves with these barbs they got. Then they breed...
Pindar, will you shut the hell up? Damn, am I tired of your whining. We're magistrates because we were born magistrates. We got a duty. If old Beauregard heard you talking like this, you wouldn't have to worry about being a mag much longer, that's for sure.
Hey now, Simon, you wouldn't really go rat me out to that tight-ass Beauregard, would you? Not really.
Behind his own visor, Simon scowled.
Damned if he didn't hate that worse than Pindar's bitching. A magistrate shouldn't whine. A magistrate should also not hesitate to inform authority of anything authority ought to know.
Simon!
That was a Mag's plain duty. At the same time, Mags owed each other a duty to be stand-up guys. Whether Simon thought he was fit to or not, Pindar did wear the black armor, did bear the crest of Baron Samarium right over his heart, same as Simon did. It wasn't Simon's place to judge whether Pindar should be a magistrate. That decision had already been made by those who justly and rightly had the power to do so. And anyway, Simon didn't like Beauregard one little bit better than his partner did. The chief magistrate was a sneaky bastard who didn't care how he ingratiated himself to the Baron. If Simon did narc off his partner for statements unbecoming to a magistrate, Beauregard was likely as not to gig him too, show his seal by purging two unworthies for the price of one. He'd justify it by claiming Simon had been tainted by Pindar's demoralizing yapping. Prove it because Simon hadn't terminated his partner himself. Disgusted with himself, with his partner, with Beauregard, and yes, with this crummy duty in this shithole swamp, Simon stamped to the end of the dock, the warped, black-stained planks thumping beneath the rubberized soles of his polycarbonate boots.
Hey, now watch it. Don't go near that water. I hear tell there's gators in these bayous, weigh as much as a sand cat. They'll jump right out of the water and snatch a man clean off a dock or the bank.
Will you knock it off with that superstitious outlander crap? There's nothing in this fucking water but shit and fish that taste like shit because all they eat is shit and other fish that eat nothing but shit. Anyway, whatever...
Something surged out of the water at the end of the dock with a greasy slog and a gurgle of heavy black water. Something seized Magistrate Simon, pride of Samariumville, around his armored ankles and whipped him into the bayou with a great resounding splash. The droplets that splashed Pindar's breastplate did indeed smell like shit. His sin-eater slammed into his right hand. He ran a few paces toward the end of the dock. Not daring to go farther, he snapped up his visor and stared at the water. It surged and roiled, but he could see no sign of Simon. This time, he couldn't muster any words. He wasn't really cut out to be a magistrate. He should have been an archivist. He'd always known that. But a mag he was born, and a mag he would die. Unfortunately, that seemed pretty much to be what was on the afternoon's agenda. He drew his copperhead with his left hand and screamed at the unseen and doubtless hideous submarine monster that had snatched his partner to a sewery doom.
Come out, you bastard! Come out and fight! Come out and take it! Take it! Take it!
In the gathering dusk, the muzzle flashes were big, yellow, with blue cores like gas jets. It seemed as if the swamp sucked in the sound the way it had sucked in Simon. Shooting and screaming, he backed unthinking toward the mound that covered the redoubt. When his back was up against it, he just let the magazines and both weapons go in one shuddering double climax of firepower. The silence when the blasters ran dry was a palpable thing, throbbing. Or was that his sobbing breath, or the blood thundering in his ears? He never got the answers to those questions worked out, because a heavy weight descended suddenly on his back. Something as big and strong and hard as an oak branch encircled his neck from behind. And then his head was twisted, helmet and all, and his neck snapped with a sound like a hand blaster shot. The last thing he saw before his vision blurred out forever was a dark face scowling into his. A cruel mouth framed by a black, downwardly curving mustache. Grant eased the flopping, clacking body of the magistrate onto the dock, unwilling to let the plastic-shelled corpse drop with a clatter by sheer habit, as though anybody in earshot wouldn't have already noticed the ripping blasts of full-auto blaster fire that had shattered the humid early evening air. From the black water of the bayou, a large shape erupted in a gout of water. It flung itself onto the dock with a squishy thump and lay for a moment.
You have really outdone yourself this time, Kane. What kind of fool stunt was that, anyway? Who the hell knows what kind of giant scaly shit lives in the water? And speaking of shit...
He sniffed loudly, then his nose wrinkled. Kane realized that if Grant could smell it, it must be pretty awful.
I'm the point man. I always go in first.
He turned his head to grin weakly at his partner.
You agreed to it. What are you bitching for?
I agreed because I'm so relieved that I wasn't the one who was going to have to swim through that nasty crap breathing through a hollow reed.
He gazed down at Pindar's lifeless form.
Damn! Your partner was right. You whined too much to be a mag.
Kane looked around to see an airboat appear around the corner 200 yards downstream. Two black-clad figures rode before the big caged fan.
Trouble.
No shit, trouble.
Grant took three long-legged strides forward, reached down, and hauled his partner to his feet as if Kane were no bigger than a hound pup.
Get your waterlogged ass in gear, partner, and we may just get out of here with all our parts. Trans jumps.
Grant was lying on his back on the floor of the chamber, deep inside Cerberus Redoubt.
The Mongols have been riding their ponies over my head, and my guts feel like they've been turned inside out. I want your job, Bridget. From now on, I wear the funny little glasses, you tote a blaster and go wading around the swamps with this heroic, suicidal joker.
You know, that prospect scares you far worse than it does me.
The tall redhead turned a cool, green gaze to Kane. Kane had gotten as far upright as his knees and was now kneeling with his head down, hands on the wet thighs of his jeans, hair hanging in his face like seaweed dripping on the floor.
Is that a frog in your pocket, or are you just glad to see me?
Kane rolled an eye down his body to the area of the left breast pocket of his khaki shirt.
I have to admit I am glad to see you, Baptiste, but that's still a frog.
A little half-grown leopard frog, green and buff, with black speckles, peered at him from a pocket of his shirt with goggly eyes and a pulsing throat. It hopped out onto the floor of the Mattrans chamber, uttering a plaintive peep, and went hopping out the door past Bridget's feet.
You can tell Lockesh we brought him a new recruit.
Tell him yourself. He's waiting in the control center. You two got back just in time. We've got another crisis here.
As afternoon wore on, Team Phoenix neared the Bighorns, whose front range they would follow at an angle up into the former Montana. They were feeling good. Reaction to the morning's duel with the chopper had not yet set in. It probably wouldn't mid-mission like this. They were making good time and practically vibrating with the feeling that they'd soon be at their objective and the real mission would begin. They were alert, but feeling fine. It was Joe Weaver in the lab's cupola who spotted the three radar returns closing from almost due east. They didn't show the profile of a direct threat. Their projected course would carry them a few clicks north of the team's current location. For safety's sake, Major Mike ordered both vehicles into the lee of a convenient bluff, clustered with granite outcrops. They couldn't hope to survive another rumble with a single attack chopper, far less three. The team left the wags and climbed up for a look. Several minutes later, a trio of aircraft cruised past at an altitude of no more than 1,000 feet. Two were black ceramic armored AH-64s. They were astonished by the third.
Okay, I give up. What is that thing?
Joe Weaver lowered his big Zeiss glasses and shrugged. Aircraft were of no great interest to him. He'd made plenty of parts for them back in the day, same as for stereo racks, Mars landers, and toilet flushers. Those had interested him to the extent they posed challenges as to how to fabricate them better, faster, cheaper. That was it. The other three were airplane buffs to a greater or lesser degree. Robeson and Reichert, who shook their heads in baffled amazement, could both fly. Robeson fixed-wing aircraft, Reichert fixed and rotary. Major Mike Hayes could fly as easily in a cockpit as by flapping his arms, yet he had perhaps the most obsessive love of airplanes of them all. He had just never had time to learn to fly them.
The mothership.
The Aurora-related black cargo and troop-carrying project caused triangular UFO sightings from your neck of the woods all the way to Belgium. Gave the Royal Belgian Air Force total fits. I heard about it through back channels.
Yeah, it was the sightings across the river in Illinois that put me onto it.
Hayes had been born in St. Louis and returned there after leaving the Corps in the mid-90s.
Wouldn't it be bigger? I mean, that thing's lots bigger than an Apache, but no larger than, say, a DC-3. That doesn't make a mothership, at least in my vocabulary.
What are you talking about?
The unlikely craft continued flying west. Crouching among rocks on a height like this, they would be spotted pretty quickly if one of the escorts decided to drift their way for a look. But no such thought entered the pilots' heads. They had someplace to be, and that was that. Robeson let Hayes take that question. Major Mike was in his glory talking about airplanes. He loved to run on about them almost as much as he did about the United States Marines.
The mothership was a lighter-than-air concept.
A blimp?
Not a blimp, not quite. A dirigible. A rigid-frame aircraft. But it took the concept a step further. The whole outside is rigid, a lifting body, a flying wing like what we just saw. Helium-filled compartments inside give lift. The shape is mostly streamlining. Inboard jet engines would provide pretty good velocity, although nothing like the 3,000 miles per hour the Belgian fighter jocks' radar showed. That was pure ECM. And this is an economy model. But I bet it's not a jet. Those cylinders on the outside looked like ducted fan engines to me. Yeah, another technology that seems to have been deployed without the taxpayers, much less us poor squatties with our ass in the grass being told. Well, time to move along. There's nothing more to see here.
He lowered his binocs and started tramping down the slope to the wags.
Wait a minute. Where are we going?
Follow them, of course. We can't pass on an opportunity like this to gather first-hand intel on the opposition.
But hey, what if they're off to vacation in the sunny New California islands?
I didn't see any extra wing tanks on those Apaches, did you? AH-64 is a short-legged bird, and it burns fuel like a blast furnace, punching through air at that altitude.
Oh.
They tracked the three choppers until they disappeared over the crest of a low hill, landing on the other side. After parking the wags in a steep arroyo, Team Phoenix crept up the hill and surveyed the strange scene below them. The largest craft had grounded on the outskirts of the sorry ville, with one of the black choppers next to it. The other Apache flew impractically close overhead, kicking up debris. What appeared to be the whole population of the settlement had been rounded up east of the town under the guns of a couple of dozen indiges, meaning indigenous forces, scarcely less shabby and scabby than the villagers themselves. These, in turn, were supervised by a cadre of 8 or 10 men in black. Half wore obvious uniforms. The other four moved with a strange stiltedness and showed glints when the lengthening sunlight caught them right, indicating they were dressed in some kind of hard-shelled full-body armor, including helmets. The helmets made Reichert snicker. He told his buddies they looked just like the ones worn by the law enforcers called judges in the British Judge Dredd comic books. To everyone's astonishment, Joe Weaver, who was in general as deaf and blind to end-of-the-millennium American popular culture as if he'd been asleep in a cave since the 1850s, caught the reference. He had actually read some of the comics. But the MIBs weren't the center of attention. That distinction went to four wispy shapes in pastel jumpsuits who presided over the proceedings from the midst of a knot of four more black-armored heavies.
I am not loving this. Their bodies are too skinny and small. Their heads are too big. Could they be mutants?
Hayes turned and looked at Robeson, who sat beside him with his knees drawn up and his elbows braced inside them to steady his own powered binocs.
What do you say now, Mr. Intellectual Squidhead?
Calling a seal squid was an instant invitation to mortal combat, but Robeson never reacted.
I say that I'm thinking the unthinkable. What if Gilgamesh wasn't Section 8? Because those little spuds sure look like what he described as hybrids to me.
Oh, ye of little faith.
Hey, like you didn't think he'd gotten too much dust on his motherboard yourself. You just couldn't admit it.
The ex-Marine quietly smirked and preened his silvery mustache with his thumb.
What are they doing?
Weaver was peering over the crest with the massive German binoculars supported only by his arms. He might as well have been carved out of granite himself for all they wavered.
Isn't it obvious? They're harvesting their human cattle to subject to some kind of obscene alien experimentation. What else?
Weaver watched a moment longer.
It does look like an Amarillo cattle auction. So what do we do now?
I don't see that we have a choice. We got our orders. The mission comes first, last, and always. We're to avoid contact. We got to get to Cerberus ASAP and prevent this bastard Dr. Lakesh from doing whatever it is he's doing to threaten America's precious purity of essence.
He slid down the grassy slope in a mini-slide of gravel and loose black dirt. The others stared at him. All of them, even lifelong civilian Weaver, knew he spoke sense. But still, the mass abduction scene was sand in the jockstrap of any red-blooded human being. 10 feet down from the crest, Hayes got to one knee. He picked up his Mag 58 7.62mm machine gun, which had been modified with a synthetic pistol grip mounted to the gas tube beneath the barrel to allow it to be used as Earth's most studly submachine gun. The FN Mag fired from a closed bolt, unlike the M60. He jacked the charging handle, then took a half-consumed cigar stub from his breast pocket and stuck it in his face.
"Now we lock and load, and kick some alien hybrid butt."
The others stared at him with jaws dropped lower than before.
"That bird we splashed had to be screaming on the radio from the moment he picked us up. So they know all about us already. We don't give anything away and get a chance to gather a lot of intel on these peckerheads and their capabilities."
"But the mission..."
Reichert's protest was purely pro forma.
"Yeah, kid, the mission. The mission's sacred. Shit, yeah."
He paused to light his stogie. The wind came out of the vill and smelled none too clean.
"There is one thing I have learned in a lifetime spent as somebody else's well-armed errand boy. Somewhere, a man's gotta draw the line."
Domi shifted her weight. The rock seemed to have started wearing holes in her belly and hip bones through her clothes. What damn good were clothes anyway if they couldn't even save your body wear and tear? The sun hung low over the bighorns behind her. Periodically, she pulled her eyes from the eyepieces to take stock of her surroundings. She had no desire to be harvested. As she picked up three specks in the eastern sky, black above the deep blue-gray of the mountains, she raised her binocs to study them. The craft to either side were mere black splinters. She guessed they were deathbirds. The object they flanked was something else entirely, a wide-humped blackness. She had no idea what it could be. Down in the captive vill, the mags showed signs of increased activity. For a moment, Domi's heart jumped at the prospect it was rising panic that the approaching aircraft were attackers. She would welcome even Cobaltville ships if they thwarted or at least rained retribution down upon the heads of the Mandeville marauders. But no, it was purposeful activity, but clearly not fearful. What the mags on the ground had been waiting for was clearly arriving in the form of the trio of flyers. Although with the wind at her back, a thing she would never have allowed had she had the least respect for magistrate tracking skills, she could hear nothing from the doomed vill, but the black-clad figures were clearly shouting at their captives and their scarcely less scabrous auxiliaries.
"So, big wheels come. Wanna look busy."
But maybe she had been wrong about one thing. Although the mag's activity was clearly not defensive, it seemed to her on an instinctual level she had learned never to mistrust or disregard that the magistrates were afraid. The escorting craft split, one rising up to orbit above the larger craft, the other dipping lower and sweeping a wide circle around the vill as if scanning for possible enemies lurking in the brush. Domi held her breath as it curved toward her. Boulders leaning together above her gave her partial overhead cover. But if the death machine looked too closely, it would see her. But again, it wasn't looking her way. It circled the vill about 50 yards out from the outermost structure. The big craft had visually resolved into a weird sort of three-lobed shape, a big central hump with a round pod or housing to either side of it. It stopped dead in air like a whirlywag. The smaller pods to either side rotated slowly until they pointed up and down. The vehicle descended to Earth. Domi had the impression from the suddenly rising whine of engines that the pods held motors of some sort that were pressing the craft down, not holding it up. Lines unrolled from the three points of the strange craft's rounded triangle shape. Magistrates ran forward, grabbed them, made them fast to parked wags. As the death bird that had flown the perimeter sweep settled down beside the bigger craft amid a standing dust devil, a panel in the big ship's flank opened up like a tongue and unfolded to the ground. Several figures walked down the ramp. Domi's breath caught in her ribs like a spiked ball. Four of the figures were slight, with childlike bodies and oversized heads. Two were completely bald. The others had blonde hair that appeared thin even at this distance. They were flanked by four mags in hard contact armor. Hybrids. Her gut tensed. She knew there were limited numbers of hybrids in existence. Kane had been told by Quavel that a mere 24 survived the destruction of the Dulce base. But perhaps Quavel was simply misinformed. Perhaps more dwelt elsewhere than Dulce or Area 51 in the Nevada desert. It was now clear that some lived in Mandeville proper, or at least kept in contact with Baron Mandeville. These four had to be either Mandeville's followers or his allies. They were not baronial class. They appeared less human, more alien. but it was so rare as to be unheard of for hybrids to appear in the open, exposed to the eyes of lowly humans. Something very compelling had to be going on. Domi began to shake. She had known all along that Mag's mercy was about the best the Ville's hapless inhabitants could expect, but now she knew beyond doubt that none would survive, for they were mere humans who had looked upon unmistakable hybrids. They would not be allowed to bear witness. For that matter, the Indiges were walking chills themselves. The hybrids from Mandeville would never trust them to keep silent about what they had seen. Even now, the auxiliaries were staring and elbowing one another's ribs. Their well-deserved fate brought Domi small comfort. She watched. As the hybrids moved toward the captive townsfolk who sat or lay under the copperheads of the Mags who'd been first on the ground, Domi had a shrewd idea of what might be going on. The Barons required special genetic transfusions on a regular basis to survive. After the Cerberus crew had demolished the base beneath Archuleta Mesa, it seemed they no longer had the means to provide them. Then Baron Cobalt revealed he had his own sources of fresh genetic material and the technology to create the life-giving baths and transfusions. For a price. The other Barons had to proclaim him their superior. That hadn't panned out very well. Cobalt failed and vanished. A new self-proclaimed imperator, the miracle-working Sam, had arisen. Now he had fallen too. But the hybrids clung tenaciously, both to life and to their increasingly tenuous hold on the top link in Earth's food chain. Mandeville's white coats had to have their own scheme to develop a rejuvenation treatment. This human harvest was to provide subjects. Even Domi, hardly a research scientist herself, could work out that the program had to be in early developmental stages. The prisoners below were pitiful, true dregs, scarcely better than muties, and many surely outright taints. The Barons and their hybrid allies insisted on only the best genes, both for their treatments and for their experiments to breed both stronger masters and better, more obedient servants. Now they clearly sought lab rats they could use for early-stage R&D. Drek, to be used up to develop the processes by which later harvests of superior types of humans could be utilized for the hybrid's designs. The hybrid quartet had the captive Ville dwellers brought before them one by one, stood watching as the Mags in uniforms, but not full armor, poked and prodded them, pried open their mouths to show their teeth, stripped them naked, and displayed them in every possible way for clinical inspection. Even though they deliberately reaped relatively low-quality material, it seemed they had some standards. They didn't want subjects with 13 toes or hidden vestigial tails. Watching from her nest of concealing sandstone above and to the west, the albino girl thought she knew why the harvesters had come hundreds of miles into Cobaltville territory to cull the human herd. Mandeville didn't want to risk stirring up his own human subjects. The magistrates would sterilize the Ville, sure. But for added security, Mandeville was doing this well outside the borders of his own barony, just in case. A lot of unforeseen mishaps had been plaguing the baronies of late. That brought a mean, hard smile to her pale lips. She and her friends had been responsible for a good many of those mishaps. There was another element as well, which she understood maybe better from growing up in the wild wastes of the Outlands than even Cain and Grant might. Mandeville was, in effect, pissing on a Cobaltville bush like an intruding dog, defying the one who claimed the turf. That was the heart of the matter, Domi knew, because she also knew this. All bosses were Guana Teague. Some had fairer forms and less overtly gross manners. Peel those wrappers back, and they all had the same brain, the same soul, and the same tiny dick. All this roiled in her mind as the sun dropped behind her and shadows stretched across the prairie, and the agonizing, dehumanizing selection process went on. Her thoughts strayed again and again to the satellite-linking radio buried at the bottom of the pack lying beside her, propping up her rifle. Was it time to swallow her pride and call her friends, tell them what was going on? Nothing'll save these poor bastards, she realized. Might as well stick tight. Watch and remember. There would be plenty of time to report after the inevitable had happened. She felt tears start hot behind her eyes. She clamped the lids fiercely shut, squeezing the moisture onto her cheeks to be quickly dried by the arid wind.
Can't do nothing. Don't know these people.
But they were her people, outlanders, as exploited as the folk of the Ville she had grown up in. And they were soon to be slaughtered like beasts, as her people had been.
When she opened her eyes, she had to blink them again and look twice. She could hardly believe what she saw. A figure crept from the brush toward one of the death birds grounded on her side of the doomed vill. With a grunt of satisfaction, Sean Reichert felt the adhesive on the plastic that covered the mouth of what looked like a small flower pot grip and hold the ceramic armor housing the Apache's starboard engine. "That's two," he told himself. "I'm good to go. So, time to be gone."
"Firebird, lover boy."
Reichert didn't say the words, he merely thought them real loud. The vibrations subconsciously produced in his larynx were the same as if he had spoken, just of lower amplitude. The tiny patch mic glued to his Adam's apple read them loud and clear. The trick with a subvoke mic was not being heard, but not being heard. They had all practiced diligently from the beginning of training, and none was perfect. Sometimes each of them let slip what were intended as private thoughts.
"Don Dias."
Reichert and Weaver were both Catholic. Reichert believed in God, but no longer in the church. Weaver was a practicing Catholic, but appeared to be atheist or highly agnostic in his belief. Hayes said he was a cultural Catholic, the way some 20th century people were cultural Mormons.
"Now all but, pronto."
Reichert's part in the preliminaries was done. His three comrades were hidden on the crest of a low hill half a click away. They would target the chopper parked by the strange craft and the one flying top cover, which foolishly orbited close above the grounded vehicle, either pulling too tight security or trying to cow a mob of captives who had obviously, Reichert thought, given up all hope of resistance years before, if not generations. He felt both pity and contempt. And also the fierce, hot warrior's joy. Payback as a mother, he thought. He eased himself off the stub wing with the 57mm rocket pod hung beneath it like strange heavy metal fruit. He slipped to the ground, flowed into a crouch, preparatory to crawling back into the weeds to make ready for the next number.
"What the fuck do you think you're doing?"
"Hey, Rube."
Sean Reichert liked to think of his brain as an ultra-fast battle computer. He'd grown up playing video games, after all. He understood on the gut level, the reflex level, what he was going to do from the microsecond his brain registered the subtle crunch of soil beneath boot sole before the new arrival had spoken. He was turning clockwise as the man opened his mouth. His right hand found the pistol grip of his sound-suppressed MP5, which hung before him on the long Israeli-style sling around his neck. His thumb slid the fire selector from safe to single, although, like all of Team Phoenix, he was well capable of squeezing off single shots in full auto mode. He didn't leave his crouch, merely straightened slightly as he extended his right hand to the point where his elbow was just shy of locking out, as if the H&K were a giant handgun. There was nothing hasty about the movement, nothing in it to trigger alarm. It looked as natural and unthreatening as turning his head. When Reichert had come into Delta Force, the operators primarily learned the gunsight combat handgun system originally developed by Colonel Jeff Cooper, despite the fact he was a jarhead. It taught a shooter always to go for a flash sight picture before squeezing off a shot, even if it cost a fraction of a second, because, as the saying went, you can't miss fast enough to catch up. But they also learned point shooting, as advocated by Reichert's personal hero, 20th century American master of mayhem Colonel Rex Applegate. Sean practiced both methods with fanatical fervor. Most times he'd shot somebody with a handgun, and there'd been a few, he had gone for and gotten his flash sight picture before making the shot. But he knew in his marrow where a bullet snap-fired from just about any mechanically possible position of arms and body would hit within a range of 10 feet to about an inch. As the MP5 reached full extension, the muzzle came to bear on its target. Reichert's fingers slipped inside the trigger guard and gently pressed. When the healthy pneumatic thump of the shot went off, accompanied by the clack of a bolt reciprocating, he was almost surprised. He wasn't the only one. The Mandeville mag had only just registered that a threat existed when the hollow-nosed 180-grain bullet, traveling just below the speed of sound, passed below the bottom edge of his slightly concave red-tinted visor, penetrated his upper lip, smashed through the roots of his teeth, punched through the roof of his mouth, and splashed most of his medulla oblongata over the padding at the back of his helmet. The crawdad-shelled body jerked spasmodically, not in response to the bullet's impact, which, like any handgun bullets, was fairly negligible, but from the command center in his central nervous system abruptly blowing out. His knees buckled and he dropped straight down. Another voice shouted from the vicinity of the chopper's quiescent tail rotor. Reichert didn't wait to continue the conversation. He rabbited straight away into the tall grass. "Hey, Rube," was Team Phoenix's code, meaning the game was up and the cards in your hands were the ones you played.
All his buddies needed now was an indication that Reichert was clear before each unleashed his own little piece of hell. As he ran, balls out right now and not bothering to dodge, Reichert's left thumb unsnapped a little black plastic cover and mashed down a red button. Even as his Sin-Eater slammed into his waiting hand, the mag by the chopper Reichert had just quitted spun in reflex response to the head-splitting noise. The shape charge was just that. It directed the high-frequency energies of its explosion with great precision. Neither the backblast spike, nasty in itself but angled up and away, nor the main focused jet of almost plasma gas did the magistrate any harm. But the yellow wall of flame as the fuel in the Deathbird's tanks blew killed him, noisily and not quickly. The pilot of the airborne Deathbird did his part to help with his own destruction. He increased his airspeed, then let the chopper drift downwind while he pivoted its nose toward the stricken craft. It was maybe the most useless place on Earth's surface he could possibly have pointed the business end of his Deathbird. At one of his own birds, now useless and on fire. It was an open invitation for Robeson, now standing in the lab's cupola. He lit off another stinger and put it right up the pipe of the chopper's right engine. The pilot and gunner commander were still in their seats in the second escort Deathbird. The engines were hot, the rotors turning over, as much to add to the intimidation factor as to be prepared to leap into the sky to the defense of the hybrid masters. The pilot changed the blade angle to bite the air and crank the throttle. Some preconscious impulse made the pilot turn his head and stare straight out the right-hand windscreen panel as his engine sped up the rotor and the Deathbird broke free of gravity's embrace. The 20-millimeter projectile that struck the polycarb panel pierced it as if it were rotten cheesecloth. It vaporized the mag's hard contact helmet and the head within it, then it exploded. By that time, the burst of launched 40-millimeter Grenz from Big Bob's turret had arrived at the party from the northeast. Ditching the spent FIM-92 launcher, Larry Robeson had dropped down into the gunner's seat. To spare the captives, as much as could be done anyway, he had slammed in a belt of high-explosive dual-purpose Grenz mixed 1-in-4 with standard smoke instead of the standard Team Phoenix mix, which included a hearty helping of white phosphorus rounds. With all their high-tech toys, the MIBs might well have passive infrared that could pick out human targets through the smoke. Their Indige auxiliaries had only eyeballs MK1 and could not. Just another little something to render the playing field even less level. Team Phoenix never played fair. It was a point of honor. The 40-millimeter grenades launched by the MK-19 weren't terribly powerful, less even than hand grenades, but Team Phoenix had unanimously chosen the auto-grenade launcher as main turret armament for the Lab 25. They loved man-portable single-shot Gren launchers, even less potent, because they gave a mighty boost to team firepower, and in the hands of an artist, such as Major Mike or Sean Reichert, they could serve as mini-mortars, dropping rounds right behind cover to get at those annoying, hard-to-reach places. Big Bob's bigger boomer, meanwhile, provided big fire on call out to beyond a click, and was good on both thin-skinned and reasonably hardened targets. The HEDP heads were deliberately inefficient-shaped charges, so that they combined a radius effect blast with the incandescent jet. Not terribly good at both, but you barely noticed the fact when a dozen or so landed on or around you. The hard contact armor of the four magistrates guarding the precious, highly secret bodies of the hybrid protected them from the feeble explosions. It was little help to the mag, who by sheer piss-poor luck took a direct hit right below his right arm. The focused blast flash-boiled the fluids inside his chest so enthusiastically that the resultant steam explosion blew his right arm right out of his body, armor and all. The others were unscathed. Not so the unprotected hybrids. Two were shredded by the barrage. One was killed instantly. The other fell kicking and mewling in its strange high voice, its right leg torn off at the hip, its belly and chest ripped by fragments, spraying its thin blood over the mags who sought to protect the masters. The other two hybrids were hustled on board the black cargo lifter by the three surviving bodyguards.
This better be good.
Grant had been summoned from the shower and had pulled on gym shorts and a t-shirt and stuck his feet in some flip-flops they had in Cerberus stores for God knew what reason. Kane was looking frosty, as usual. He'd been fetched from the cafeteria where he had been sitting and eating. Bridget Baptiste had been sitting across the table from him. Neither had been saying anything.
They were the only people in the room when Grant stuck his head in the door, and they were acting like strangers who'd been forced to sit together by crowding.
Oh, it is. Trust me.
Kane sipped coffee from a spun metal mug.
I don't trust anybody who doesn't have a blaster on him. Neither does Grant. Show him if you got him, Banks. We're not in the mood for games.
Despite Lakesh's insistence that a state of emergency existed, the pair had gone directly to bed after jumping back into the redoubt. It was, as Grant observed, always an emergency with Lakesh. They were washed out from sleepless days and nights of skulking through the bayous, being hunted by mags and vengeful swampers, not to mention the Mattrans jump itself. They had slept clear through until afternoon. Bridget had insisted they be allowed to because the situation, however seriously it might develop, showed no sign of immediate urgency. Reasonably rested, but still even grumpier than usual, the two confronted a hyped-up Lakesh and an excited Banks.
We recorded this just a few minutes ago. It came over on a Mandeville Mag Division frequency, reserved for highest priority traffic, and in a crypto variant we hadn't seen before. We broke it, though.
Banks pressed a button. Frantic words sprang out of the speakers.
By unidentified forces. Number unknown, but there must be a platoon at least. We've lost two masters and had to abandon the subjects under intense fire. Mayday! Mayday! Hive, we are under attack. We are attempting to initiate return. We are...
That's a mag dying.
Kane casually sipped his coffee.
Friends, that broadcast originated in northern Cobaltville territory only a couple of hundred miles south and east of here.
So, Mandeville came poaching on Cobalt preserves and got its dick caught in a bear trap. Wonder how Cobaltville got on them so quick. What with their mag division being a bit depleted in all these days.
We show no sign of Cobaltville traffic or activity in the area. Indeed, we suspect this incident may pertain to the matter we've been waiting to brief you on after you recovered from the jump.
You mean Domi walking out on Lakesh?
No. A more urgent matter entirely.
But not necessarily unconnected. Our telemetry shows Domi's current location very near the origin point of the broadcast we just heard.
Either trouble finds that girl or she finds it. Always happens. What masters? Who's a mag calling master?
It is my belief that the term may refer to Archon human hybrids overseeing a harvesting mission.
Whoa.
Grant and Kane exchanged glances.
Why?
The hybrids, the Barons in particular, are in dire need of rejuvenation treatments. With sources disrupted or destroyed, it may well be that other baronies are trying to develop the means of creating them on their own.
And they're desperate enough to send hybrids along to oversee the op.
We've put a dent in the bastards.
So who's flash-blasting the Mandeville mags?
We don't know, but we are beginning to suspect a new player has entered the Outlands power game.
Who?
An erstwhile colleague of mine, friend Kane. A fellow architect of the totality concept. A man dead for almost 200 years.
Figures. It couldn't be anything normal.
Reichert fled across the prairie in the general direction of the Bighorn foothills, darting off at what he hoped were unpredictable angles to throw off his pursuer's aim. It may have been effort wasted since none was bothering to aim. No bullets came appreciably close. The magistrate, backing up the clot of pursuing mercies, was driving them like sheep. Their best bet would have been to drop, aim, and shoot, because fast as Reichert's skinny ass could move when he was well and truly inspired, he couldn't outrun bullets. The armored mag, known as Flood, understood too well that once his less-than-steady allies bit dirt, they wouldn't aim and shoot, but snivel and hide. So instead of shooting the Sin-Eater in his fist, he bellowed threats to keep his men in the hunt. As he ran, Reichert popped off the safety strap holding the big pistol-looking item strapped to his left hip and pulled the blaster from its brake-front holster. Like the MP5, it really was just an outsized handgun, this time single shot. He broke to his right, tucked, half-rolled, came up in a seated posture facing the pack. The nearest members were less than 10 yards behind him. He pointed the hefty piece two-handed and fired. It was another fine Heckler & Koch product, this time a 40mm Gren launcher. Up the spout, he carried a multiple projectile round. The short barrel let the MP charge get a fine old spread. The Gren launcher used a low-pressure push to avoid busting the shooter's wrist or shoulder. The pellets weren't fast, moseying along at less than 500 feet per second. It ripped through the three auxiliaries closest to Reichert. The foremost, who caught most of it in his chest, folded, rolled, and lay still with his heart shredded. The one to his left stopped and dropped to his knees, clutching a twice-perforated gut and barfing blood.
The one on the other side began shrieking and waving the mangled stub of his left upper arm, sending out big, thick blood pulses from the severed brachial artery. Heeding their examples, about half the remaining 10 or so Mercies flopped into the buffalo grass. The others wheeled and promptly fled.
Move, you gutless worm turds! Chase them!
One Mercy almost collided with him. The man had saliva trailing along a lean, unshaved jowl from among brown-stained, jumbled teeth.
Fuck you!
That was something Outland scum didn't say to a mag. The magistrate shoved the perforated barrel shroud of his sin-eater almost into the belly of the Mercy's sweat-stained shirt and gave him a tri-burst. The man howled as blood squirted out his back and sides. He fell flopping on the grass with his shirt on fire. It smelled really bad. The other auxiliaries turned once again to the chase, deriving the hoped-for moral lesson that what ran before was less to be feared than what ran behind. Unfortunately, that was wrong, too. No sooner had he touched off the booming blast than Reichert was up and running again. Left-handed, he was fully ambidextrous, he cracked open the breech and rolled the short, smoking, empty case onto the ground. Letting his grenade launcher flop at the end of his sling, his right hand had already pulled a fresh round from a loop on his belt. This one was a full-sized R2-D2-shaped launch gren, not the abbreviated ashcan shape of a multiple projectile. Reichert had a happy new surprise for his playmates. A blaster snarled from behind him, sharp, nasty, and somehow authoritative. A burst of bullets kicked up a line of dirt and grass not 10 feet to the left of him. Given it was full auto from a handgun, fired on the run, that was pretty good shooting. Reichert bent forward, head tucked down, to look along the launcher's sight. He was mainly concerned that he not drop the projectile uselessly short in the dirt, because he dared not waste a shot. This baby wouldn't explode until it had spun out 20 yards from the barrel. It was a longer safety range than most 40mm grenades took. There were good reasons for that. The launcher tunked. The gren plopped right in the midst of the pursuing pack and blew. Its blast sent three of the Mercies sprawling. None was incapacitated. Not yet. The blast wasn't much, but it sufficed to send out hundreds and hundreds of white tendrils in a nifty dandelion head pattern. At the very end of each tendril was what looked like a little miniature star glowing brightly. Each star was a fragment of white phosphorus, burning hot enough to melt through steel. Unquenchable by any available means, they burned as happily underwater as in air, or flesh. The Mercies who had had the blazing frags blasted into them began to shriek and thrash as flame jetted from their arms and bodies and heads. So did the ones who'd been lightly dusted. A few of these were lucky enough to bat away the pellets, although they clung tenaciously to whatever they struck as they burned their relentless way into it. These got away with burns of varying degrees of severity, and absolutely no desire to continue the pursuit under any conceivable threat from behind. The rest either flailed in place or ran, and very fast indeed, but not fast enough to escape the miniature infernos that consumed them like armies of supernatural soldier ants. Magistrate Flood's polycarbonate armor shielded him from the blast and kept the pellets away from him for the moment. He slogged forward, running as fast as he could with limbs restricted by the suit, knowing he was on his own now. White smoke poured from a score of places on his armor where the pellets had struck. The acrid stink of phosphorus, the stench of melting plastic, and the barbecue odor of burning Mercy flesh made him cough. The scumbag who was causing all this grief had gone to ground. Flood set off a burst from his sin-eater at the stand of waist-high grass where the fugitive had vanished. He got no response. The bastard was probably smart enough to crawl after belly-flopping. Crawl as you might, he thought, you cannot escape the wrath of Magistrate Flood.
What the hell?
He got that right. The swarm of other fragments finished eating through the armor and internal padding, clung to skin and dug right in. Magistrate Flood began his very last dance, accompanied by his own screams, and before he finally fell, his gyrations were all but totally obscured by a vast cloud of dirty white smoke. 100 yards from the lab, Major Hayes, lying on his gut in the grass with the machine gun's integral bipod down, methodically hosed the soft-skinned trucks with 7.62mm NATO rounds. Steam spurted from beneath hoods as radiators were perforated. Wags settled deeper onto their sorry, rusty excuse for springs as tires were vented. One of the wags bloomed into flame, red with dense black smoke just pouring into the sky. Hayes switched his aim to the Indige troops. Team Phoenix's presumption was that all the Vill dwellers had been rounded up and disarmed. None who'd managed to hide were likely to emerge at the racket of a wicked firefight. Anybody not in a clump of captives was by definition hostile. Hayes scrupulously kept his fire away from the civilians. He knew his team would, too. Not because they were bleeding hearts, but because they were professionals. Besides, it was a target-rich environment. With a whine of turbines, the big black cargo chopper fairly jumped into the air. The mooring line sprang free of the craft's nose and tail. The pops of the small explosive charges that cleared them were delayed by distance from reaching Robeson's ears for a couple of beats.
You do not get away!
He hosed the big black chopper with launch grenades. Fire and smoke danced along the black flanks, but to no visible effect. The airship gained altitude more slowly now, but steadily. As the engine pods began to rotate to the horizontal, Robeson gave up on the MK-19 and ducked into the turret. Hayes was on the comm.
Bones, don't bother with a stinger. Won't ever guide on the engine's exhausts. That's a stealth bird every way.
Robeson popped back into view like a big bearded prairie dog. He was shouldering a stubby cylinder with fore and aft pistol grips and a scarcely less bulky sight assembly paralleling it. It was a Milan III anti-tank rocket launcher, state-of-the-art when Team Phoenix began its long winter's nap, with a dual-stage warhead to defeat armor designed to shrug off shaped charge warheads, which is what the fat black delta-shaped lifter was doing. As the lifter pivoted, trying to head east and goose it home and away from this utterly unexpected hell zone, Robeson fired the Milan. The crack of the warhead snapped belatedly down the wind to his ears. The craft quit turning with the nose pointed vaguely southeast. The ducted fan engine pods, in the process of rotating back to horizontal flight regime to boost the airship, went silent and locked about 30 degrees skewed from the ship's main axis. For no reason the team was ever likely to discover, the Black Delta was tipped about 15 degrees down by the nose. But upraised like a stink bug's, it began to drift slowly east-southeast on the wind at an altitude of 200 feet. Robeson lowered the empty launcher and admired his handiwork.
Now that's something else you don't see every day.
Two more and you make ace. Now drop your socks and grab your cock. We got us a town to clean up.
Senior Magistrate Cooley crouched behind a slumped adobe pedestal. It had a small beam sticking off its top, from which hung a sign that swung creaking in the ceaseless prairie wind. Faded to just this side of illegibility was the legend, "Welcome to Ozone Hole." Cooley had actually kind of appreciated the irony, before the sky fell in on him and his command. For the first time in his life, he felt powerless despite the comforting weight of his sin-eater in his hand. Things had gone south with a suddenness he couldn't comprehend. How the hell had Cobaltville fallen wise to them so fast? The neighboring and now rival barony was supposedly in disarray, its mag division devastated by a couple of its own gone rogue, as well as the recent battles with rival baronies. How had they brought so much firepower down without us spotting them, Cooley wondered. He looked around. Two mags were in sight, Lowry lying not 10 yards away near the moaning, shivering mass of captives. Sullivan crouched in the doorway of the nearest hut. Each man had his sin-eater and copperhead in hand. Not that they'd do any good. They were taking fire from three directions. He'd lost contact with his men on the west end of the vill, where there had been plenty of shooting going on. It had now slacked off. This side of the settlement was getting hit by a machine gun and some kind of autocannon, possibly a big Gren launcher, from at least 500 yards to the northeast. Another blaster had made a noise like the crack of doom, firing from somewhere to the southeast, had smoked several trucks, and was now slamming shots into the Sandcat. They apparently had no effect on the heavily armored wag. Big consolation that was. Firing broke out behind him again, a sin-eater blaring not in tri-bursts but sheets of lead. He was basically helpless. It wasn't right that a Mandeville magistrate should feel helpless, and a senior mag at that. He started to get mad. Reichert was back in town. His pursuers were fled and mostly dead. That meant it was his turn to go hunting. His partners were raising all kinds of hell on the far side of the tiny bird. He saw the mothership rise up and get smacked by a Milan III anti-tank rocket, saw it begin to drift, obviously out of control. That made him feel good inside. Nothing made his day better than spoiling it for bad guys. And he had to admit that not even his erstwhile Special Forces buddies had ever done it better than his current team. Old Gilgamesh may have been mad, he reflected, but maybe he wasn't crazy after all. He found himself hunkered in the doorway of a truly nasty squat, trading shots with one of the MIVs 20 yards down the alley. Air wafting out from the gloom within, which he was just as happy not to be able to see through, smelled like raw sewage. The guy in the black suit was one game son of a bitch, he had to admit. Most of his pals were smoked or smoking already, and he had to know it. And while Reichert was very careful not to take for granted any bad guy with a weapon and a finger to pull the trigger, he suspected the black armored fighter held his Indige allies in the same low regard Reichert did, if not lower. But he was whacking back and coming way too close. Fortunately, he displayed a childlike faith in spraying and praying. It was clearly deliberate. This wasn't just letting your whole mag go in one shrieking orgasm of panic fire. The guy was shooting with intent, which meant he wasn't used to playing against opposition of a high enough caliber to grasp deep concepts like cover and concealment. Reichert ducked back into the rounded doorway as a fresh burst bit into the frame. The wood was ancient and splintery, but not as cheesy as it looked. None of the bullets punched through. He lacked confidence in its staying power. He squinted into the hooch, seeking some tactical edge to grab to break the deadlock. He didn't look behind him. Leo chuckled to himself. He was gonna bag him a rogue, a genuine Baron Blaster. Just a few more feet. He kept his good eye trained on the hut's door where the stranger crouched. The guy had on some kind of uniform, neat and clean, no patches even. He had to have come from some barony somewhere, but Leo couldn't figure out which one or what division. Leo had had an ID implant to live in the Tartarus pits beneath Mandeville once, before he got exiled for being generally undesirable. He considered himself something of an authority on Vils, though, from his time under one. He hoped to recoup his lost status as a mercy serving Mandeville. Now he had his eye set on higher stakes. He would get rewarded big time for chilling one of these intruders, for doing what the high and mighty Mandeville mags in their black armor couldn't do. Maybe he'd get full citizenship this time. Maybe they'd make him a mag. One thing sure, the Barony Mag Division was going to be short-handed big time when this fight was through. He raised the splintery, faded stock of his single-shot 10-gauge, its barrel held in place by bright turns of copper wire, to his shoulder. His blackened and crack-nailed finger sought the trigger. At the familiar sound, like a ripe melon whacked with an axe, Reichert spun, knowing he was screwed, realizing he wasn't. The Indige had him dead to rights. Reichert found himself staring up the train tunnel-sized bore of a god-awful old scattergun. Had it gone off, it was a toss-up which one of them it would have wasted. But one thing was in no question. The bastard had Sean's young ass on a plate. Except the Indige's eyes, one bright blue, one cataract milky, were staring in eternal surprise over the gushing ruin of the lower half of his face. Domi reflexively worked the bolt of her rifle, chambering a new cartridge, before pumping her pale fist in the air.
Yes! I got you, mercy scum!
She wasn't worried about being heard. Aside from the distance involved, over 500 yards, there was too much noise down in the Ville, and the Mandeville marauders had too much on their minds to hear. She drummed her feet into the ground in a horizontal dance of triumph. Then she got back behind her scope with the rifle's butt plate snug to her shoulder. It had been a good shot, but it had also been a way lucky one. The head shot was a bonus. She had been aiming for the center of the guy's chest, mainly hoping to distract him and get him to make some noise to warn his intended prey. Chilling him, of course, was better. Big time. If she had ever harbored any naive notions about her enemy's enemy being her friend, the Byzantine cycles of conspiracy and betrayal she'd experienced in the months since fleeing to Cerberus with Cain, Bridget, and Grant had long since crushed the life from them. These uniformed strangers might be no better than mags, but they were chilling mags and doing a pretty amazing job of it, too. And someone who chilled your enemies was at least chilling your enemies, and she figured it deserved such encouragement as she could provide, no matter what shook out later.